And good evening, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. I'm your friendly host. You know, every time I say that, I think of that old Casper, you know, cartoon, the friendly ghost. But that's the other show that does that stuff. Before I begin this morning with my guest, I want to go to Radio with Pictures. You all know the drill by now. You go to the homepage, othersideofmidnight.com. You click on the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures. That takes you to the show page for tonight. And the very first link on the show page is an astonishing image from NASA. Make sure you click on it, because that will enlarge it. This is Keith Laney's enhancement, a very lightly once-over enhancement. But it's the Ceres Pyramid, the so-called Lone Mountain, which is between 4 and 5 miles tall, and is 12 miles in diameter, and it's not circular, it's oblong. In fact, it looks kind of like a relu tetrahedron as seen from the side. And you can see an astonishing amount of geometry now on the top, on the flat mesa-like top, because it's like a step pyramid. It comes up sharply at about a 45-degree angle, and we're looking down the far side, so our view from the side is about 45 degrees. At the massive crater to the left of it, and the rest of the small craters around it. But the top of this thing and the sides, the fluted sides, the geometry, this thing is not natural. Did I mention that it's the only one of its kind on this whole surface of Ceres, this 600-mile-wide little world, the first known asteroid, the first named by the IAU back in 2006 dwarf planet? Anyway, in terms of a geological process, what is it that can produce one of anything anywhere in the solar system? Doesn't happen. Although, if you invoke the idea of intelligence, intelligence produces one-offs all the time. I mean, among our imaging team, you know, Will and Alan and Keith and Bob and Andrew, and we're adding some more folks. You know, I want to bring my friend Ron into this at some point in L.A. We're kind of making this little internal wager. My bet is that we're looking at an ancient flying city, an arcology that flew through space, and somehow, after the catastrophe that happened a long, long time ago, but not in a galaxy far, far away, in fact, right next door, this object came to ground on Ceres. I think it landed. I think it crash-landed. I think it was an effort to save whoever was inside on the nearest place that had potential resources, facilities, whatever. I mean, there's been so much destruction in the millions of years since the posited war. Anyway, that would take us into a whole new realm. We don't have time for that tonight, but I wanted you to go to the website and click on this astonishing image and take a good, close look, because there's a game changer coming. NASA and the other space agencies, as we've now been tracking for years, particularly accelerating the last few months, is downloading the most astonishing images of uncontestably ancient geometric manufactured things all over the solar system. Not just NASA, but ESA, the 67P mission, the Rosetta mission, this Dawn mission, the Curiosity mission to Mars, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter missions to the Moon, and then when they released all those Apollo Hasselblad photographs, which I wanted to talk about during our discussion last Saturday morning, and somehow they didn't kind of get uploaded, but there are stunning comparisons between the geometry seen in the Hasselblads that now NASA has released and images that the Surveyor Project, another part of NASA, have been working on to scan from the films, from the TV transmissions back in the mid and late 60s. And on those images, the one that they released so far is a test. The same kind of rebar in the sky, the same kind of glass geometry seen against the inky blackness of space is visible in both shots on the moon. So there's this accelerating curve of kind of creeping disclosure. All it's going to take is one spark, one match to change the world from the direction we're currently headed into a totally new orbit, a totally new arc, a totally new frontier, because all you have to do is officially acknowledge that we are not alone, that there's someone else out there, and they left a lot of stuff in our neighborhood, and suddenly everything changes. And to discuss the idea of a game changer, I mean, I'm thinking of the fact that right now the president is of the United States is in Paris tonight with 150 world leaders, the largest single assemblage of world leaders, we are told, in written history. Wouldn't that be an opportune time for the president to take out some photographs and kind of pass them around and say, hey guys, we have something much more interesting to deal with than ISIS. We have a whole paradigm shift. We have to bring this planet into the 21st century, all of us together, because together we're stronger against whatever's out there, and there must be something out there, than we are individually. Could that happen? I don't know. It seems kind of an appropriate moment if our calculations about timing and rituals and secret societies and long-term plans and all that have any credence in reality. So, with that as forethought prologue, I want to bring my guest on tonight, Dr. Richard Spence, who is a professor of history at the University of Idaho. Dr. Spence has been on the show a couple of times before, and I frankly find our discussion so intriguing that whenever I have a kind of a conundrum that has to do with the Middle East and the machinations going on around it now, the first person I think to ask is Richard, because he's got some very interesting answers. So, without further ado, Dr. Spence, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
It's my pleasure to be on, Richard.
Okay, where should I begin? The last time we did a show, we managed to get from the formation of Islam, you know, Angel Gabriel appearing to Muhammad, modest young camel driver who becomes a very upward mobile guy in the prophet business and spokesperson business, and manages to found a whole new religion that now is followed by something like 1.5 billion people on this planet. And we got that process all the way up to just before World War I and the Ottoman Empire, and we had to quit because we ran out of time. Well, the last show that I did with a friend of mine, Chris Knowles, he surprised me with something astonishing that I sent to you earlier today, which is a calendar of a very rudimentary effort at making a calendar of these terrorist events going back, you know, a couple of decades. And what he did was he began to correlate alongside these events and their times and dates equivalent historical moments in the history of the Ottoman Empire, and lo and behold, he called me up and he said, you won't believe what I found. This damn stuff actually works. There's something here. There's a model. So I sent it to you earlier, and I thought it would be part of our discussion tonight. Why don't we talk about the Ottoman Empire and how it kind of became that first caliphate that the ISIS folks now claim they want to rebirth and reinitialize?
Well, we'll pick things up, I guess, from the Ottoman Empire, how to introduce that. For centuries, it was a really big deal.
Okay.
I mean, to the fact that it was
kind of like in the class of Biden whispering in the president's ear, this is a really big deal.
It was a major power on the world scene.
Compared to Rome or the British Empire or us, how did it rank?
In terms of territory, it probably came close to... Now, the British Empire, I think, has an edge on just about anybody except possibly the Russians.
Okay.
In terms of land area at its peak. Ottoman Empire, let me sort of describe it roughly at its peak, you know, and listeners can pull out their handy atlas, or they can imagine this.
Hey, Google is their friend, and everybody has a screen.
Google is their friend. You can Google Ottoman Empire, and it will give you this idea. But what many people think of is they think of the modern country of Turkey, the Republic of Turkey. That was the core of the empire. So what is the Republic of Turkey today? I think it's important to keep in mind, was the core. Let's put it this way. If it was to the Ottoman Empire what Italy was to the Roman Empire.
Okay.
All right? That's about as close approximation I could get. So that's the core. The Ottoman Turks were the dominant people. They were the military people who formed that empire, who conquered it and brought all the other lands and peoples who were part of that empire under their control. So it encompassed that, but it also included most of southeastern Europe. And I'm talking about southeastern Europe that would include everything that's today Greece and Bulgaria, what used to be Yugoslavia, Serbia, and Croatia, all the way up to Budapest in Hungary, in the middle of Europe, and in fact, at its peak, reaching right up to the gates of Vienna. Romania would have been included in that as well. The whole the Black Sea at one point was an Ottoman lake.
Okay.
That is, Crimea was a tributary state to the Ottoman Empire. And then it controlled the Middle East, so everything that is today Iraq and Syria and Israel and Palestine and Jordan, plus all the coastal areas of the Arabian Peninsula, all the way down to Yemen, all the way down to the very southern part of Arabia. The holy cities of Mecca and Medina were part of the Ottoman Empire. The interior of Arabia was full of Arab tribes that basically recognized the power of the empire and paid it tribute. And then Egypt was part of the empire. And then Libya was part of the empire. And then what was today? Tunisia and Algeria were part of the empire.
So it spread down and across North Africa.
All the way across North Africa. And if we took a kind of snapshot, I could give you the idea. The Ottoman Empire at its peak of power, you could identify with a particular Ottoman ruler, Suleiman the Magnificent. And he didn't get called Magnificent for no reason. He ruled the empire from around 1520 to 1566, 16th century. So think of him as a contemporary of Henry VIII or of Charles V. Precedes a little bit Elizabeth I of England, all in the same sort of century. And at that time, when Suleiman the Magnificent...
And with roughly the same technologies, I presume.
And roughly the same technology. In fact, if anything, the Ottomans might have had an edge in technology because the empire, through all of the taxes it was collecting throughout that territory, was a very sloppy tax system, but one that brought in so much money that it was wealthy, trade was flourishing. Its navy was the strongest in the Mediterranean. Its army was probably the most powerful on land. There was no single European Christian state, even France, certainly not England, who could have individually challenged the power of the Ottomans under Suleiman. And this was the kind of, and in some ways, if you look back from today's perspective, if you want to look back with nostalgia on the golden age of the Islamic Ottoman Empire, that would be the period. It would be the reign of Suleiman the Magnificent. Because with any golden age, you know, after the Magnificent, it's downhill. And the successors to Suleiman were never able to hold the empire together. It really began to crumble. It didn't. Its power was a very slow decline. But really, from his death in the late 1500s, the empire declined. And there's another little historical event that serves as an example of that. He died in 1566, I think in 1571, somewhere around there. There was a big naval battle off the coast of what is today Greece called the Battle of Lepanto. And that pitted the Ottoman fleet, a galley fleet, by the way, because they were still fighting with galleys. A galley fleet, the pride of the Ottoman Navy, confronted a combined Christian fleet, and the Spaniards and the Habsburgs and the Pope contributed to this. And it was a crushing Ottoman defeat. Most of the fleet was destroyed.
And was this the first time that the two sides had basically met in naval contest?
Well, there have been lots of naval contests before. Never. Usually what the Ottomans had been fighting were the Venetians. Venice was, you know, a relatively small state. It's kind of a city-state and an empire of assorted islands they had captured. But the Venetians had fought more or less a kind of losing battle to try to hold the Ottomans back. They hadn't been very successful at that. And Lepanto was where the Venetians, the Habsburgs, which controlled Spain and Austria, and you even got the church behind it, combined together in order to be able to challenge. But it took all of those forces to create a naval force that could challenge the Ottomans. And thanks in part to, here's another, thanks in part to the fact that the Christian fleet had more and better cannons.
Mm.
Okay. This is where that came into that. They had a superior use of firearms, and this was an edge that the Ottomans were going to lose and the Christian West was going to gain more and more. But Lepanto was this kind of turning point. The Ottomans rebuilt their navy, it's fair to mention, and they built it back, but it never had the power that it did before, and they never controlled the eastern Mediterranean as they did.
Kind of like Spain and the hurricane and the attempted invasion of Britain that collapsed because of the destruction of the Spanish fleet?
In some ways. You could say that the Spanish Armada was this kind of tipping point. That before that, Spain was the great power in the Atlantic, and after it, England becomes the power. There's this kind of transition between the two.
Mm-hmm.
So Lepanto was the kind of opening of the Ottoman decline. The military that had succeeded over and over again and had conquered this huge empire now failed. And what happened, there were many, many wars, which were, the Ottomans were almost always at war with someone. If they weren't at war with Christian states in the West, they were at war with the Persians in the East. That's kind of interesting to note, is that the Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empire were bitter enemies.
And Persia, of course, is current-day Iran, but it's been Islamified.
Right. But also, it is a Shia Islamic empire, and the Ottoman Empire is very closely linked to Sunni or Orthodox Islam.
Hmm.
So while the Persians and the Ottoman Turks were both Muslims, they were different types of Muslims, and along with having different geopolitical goals as well. So they're constantly at each other's throats. So warfare is, in fact, one of the things that just kind of drains the lifeblood of the empire. There's never any kind of, funny how that happens, but that tends to be one of the things that will have, the constant warfare. So the Ottomans, after 1571, will win victories and they'll lose battles. But what happens is that as the decades go on, they lose more than they win, and then they lose all the time.
Hmm.
So by the time we get to the 1700s, the Ottoman Empire is already beginning to be talked about as the sick man of Europe. Its military is out of date. It generally loses the wars it becomes involved in. It can still put up a fight. It still holds on to most of its territory, but that's beginning to slip away. And then in the 19th century, whole cascade of, one way to put it is the Ottoman Empire had problems. By the 18th century, the empire had problems. By the 19th century, those problems had become crises. They were things that threatened the life of the empire itself. And those were its military weakness. It was the rise of nationalism and insurrectionary movements among the subject peoples in the Balkans and elsewhere. Egypt would slip away from their grasp. Greece and Serbia and the other Balkan countries would gradually slip away from their control. And then compounding this was financial problem. And one of the things that happens is that in the 1870s, the Ottoman Empire goes bankrupt.
That's not very good for empires.
Well, there's a certain lesson you can look at in modern times, because there's the whole question about how states go bankrupt and what happens when they do. And the Turks had done, what they thought they needed to do to try to keep up with the other people in the neighborhood. They borrowed money.
Mm.
And they borrowed money from European bankers, mostly in Paris, in France. I bet there are any number of rulers in Africa who could identify with this. And in Latin America. They borrowed money from Western European banks at what appeared to be advantageous levels of interest, and what eventually happens is that the bankers end up in control not only of their natural resources, but eventually of controlling their state finances. But the Ottoman Empire goes bankrupt. It owes this money, basically, to the British and the French. And eventually what's set up is that there's an international rescue which comes in.
What?
And they set up, yes, well, they have to, well, See, this is the problem if you're a banker, and the problem with bankruptcy. You know, they really hate that because that means that technically you don't have to pay the money back.
Well, yes.
This is why also the British and the French are determined to keep the Ottoman Empire alive. So one of the things is that throughout the 19th century, all the way up till World War I, the Ottoman Empire has been on life support. Really, it's a state that should have died off about 100 years before. It should have crumbled into its constituent parts. But the empire had to be kept alive as a political corporate entity so that it could pay the debt. And the way that it pays the debt is that the bankers and the international community come in and they set up the Ottoman State Debt Commission, which essentially brings foreigners in to manage your state finances and control the revenues and then take off the top of those revenues money to pay all the debts that you acquired and which drove you into bankruptcy. So the Ottomans don't even have full control over their economy at that point. And there are more and more foreigners, all of which, from their view, are infidels who are coming in and telling them what to do. If you want to modernize your military, you have to bring in the British or the French, and then towards the end of the 19th century, the Germans. We'll bring in the Germans because we can play those off against the British and the French. And they'll train the army. And this really becomes the problem of this empire, which is losing control. Well, I mentioned the crime state lost control of Egypt. And Egypt, by the way, was a very rich prize. That Egypt was a breadbasket in terms of producing food, it had been since ancient times. And the way in which this was lost, it's kind of a little story in of itself. It started in the around 1800, the beginning of, you know, late sort of American Revolution, French Revolution period, up to the early 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And what had happened is that
1800 is when Tom Jefferson is president.
Yeah, so we'll say that these events are sort of on either side of 1800, but if you wanted to peg it to a particular area, this is when this is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And what basically happened is that an example of the empire's weakness is that the Ottomans couldn't rule Egypt directly. They ruled it through this kind of local aristocracy. They sort of left the old aristocracy of people called the Mamluks, who, by the way, were not native Egyptians, but had come in and taken over earlier. They sort of ran it as a side enterprise and then, of course, paid money back to Constantinople and the Sultan. But one of the things that had happened is that in the course of Europe's wars, Napoleon and the French invaded Egypt.
Mm.
So you've probably, there's always a story which is told about this, the Sphinx.
Yes, okay, and the Mamluks.
And the Sphinx's nose. So have you ever heard the story of how the Sphinx lost its nose?
Mm-hmm. But you can tell it again because this audience hasn't heard.
And there are people who will dispute this, but nonetheless, it's a good story. Well, the French army had invaded Egypt and had taken it over and decided to have target practice. And using their cannon, fired at the Sphinx. And they did use the Sphinx as target practice. Whether they actually shot the nose off, I guess you'd have to be there to see. But that's one of the stories that came out of it. So the French have invaded it, and then, of course, the British counter-invade to drive out the French. And what this is left with is that Egypt, is this very rich province, is now just sort of chaotic because the French are defeated, and they leave, and then the British leave, and the French leave, and there's no one in control. So the Sultan looks around, and his regular army is too thinly spread and too ill-prepared to undertake this. So he hires a bunch of Albanian mountain men in the Balkans. And here again, explain, Albanians are in the same place they were then. They're not in Turkey, but what is Albania in the Balkans was part of the Ottoman Empire. The Albanian tribes were, most of them were, fairly warlike, and they would hire themselves out as mercenaries. And so some thousands of these mercenaries were hired to basically go down and restore order and keep sending money back to Constantinople.
Mm.
Well, what happened is that the Albanian mercenaries got there, and they took over Egypt, all right. And then they decided it was such a nice place, they were going to keep it for themselves. So they acknowledged, the rulers of Egypt after that, acknowledged that the Sultan was really their boss. But twice, in the 1830s, the ruler of Egypt, this Albanian-installed ruler of Egypt, invaded the Ottoman Empire and marched on Constantinople. So he raised a separate Egyptian army. This guy's name, by the way, was Muhammad Ali, not the boxer, but the Egyptian ruler.
God.
And he raised an army. He hired Napoleonic French officers to train it and arm it with the most modern weapons, and it whipped the Ottomans twice. So here he had a case of a rebellious province attacking the empire itself and coming within an ace of succeeding. It was only, again, the intervention of outside powers, the British, the French, even the Russians had become involved, that forced Muhammad Ali to stop.
And that was because of the bankers not wanting to have the cash flow interrupted, right?
Because if the Sultan goes out of business, who's going to pay them? So,
God.
I mean, here again is an example that they're not doing this out of any philanthropic, humanitarian gesture. They're doing it, in a sense, because they have been bleeding the empire, and they want to bleed it until it is completely dry. And they don't think that's happened yet. So, the sultans who ruled the Ottoman Empire in this period had to face a number of these realities, and the reality was that their empire was the sick man of Europe, that it has lost control of its finances, and it was, you know, seemingly they were always one step behind in modernizing things. Eventually, this is going to lead to resentment. No matter how much you go, you're always going to be looking at a way to get out of it. And this is why, for instance, what it sort of leads up to the First World War and the Ottoman Empire's involvement in that. And, of course, in the First World War, the Ottomans joined the war as an ally of Germany and Austria against Britain and France and Russia. Now, one of the reasons they do that is that if you understand the financial background to this, is that, well, if you join your creditors' enemies and defeat them in battle, well, then you're going to be free of all those pesky debts, right?
Fascinating.
So what happened is that beginning in like the 1890s, and then in the early 20th century, Ottoman rulers began to court the Germans because they saw Germany as a rising power. I mean, you're dealing with the infidel power, so how do you deal with them? You play them off against each other. The Germans seem to be powerful. They seem to make the British and the French nervous, and therefore align yourself with them to free yourself from the control of the others. Of course, just coming under German control, but you'll deal with that later on. But in between, there's a curious event that occurred. There are a couple of things that they're worth mentioning. One is that the Ottoman Sultan, the emperor of this empire, and, you know, Suleiman was the great one back in the 16th century. And by the early 20th century, you've got this guy in the throne called Abdulhamid II. Abdulhamid is maybe better known by his nickname, the Red Sultan.
Tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. You are setting us up perfectly for the next segment because I want to talk about the current Turkey and the fact that, to my untutored eye, it's almost like the current Turkey is seeking to reinstate the Ottoman Empire in the caliphate that ISIS says it needs. So don't go away. My guest this morning is Dr. Richard Spence, and we're talking about Islam now in the form of the Ottoman Empire, poised at the crescendo of World War I, and the shaping of the world that we have now inherited, for better or for worse. Hopefully this will be illuminating, so stay tuned. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. We are back. My guest this morning, Dr. Richard Spence. Richard, you made an interesting point during the break. Why don't you mention it to our audience about this interesting connection now to the caliphate?
Well, yeah, one of the things that the Islamic State claims that it wants to create is a caliphate. And, you know, very quickly, one of the things that we discussed the last time I was on was that the caliph, the caliphate, is the kind of successor to the prophet Muhammad. It's not exactly the Muslim pope. That's not really what it's about. But he is the prince of the faithful. He is the spiritual leader of the Muslim community everywhere. And these were to be the series of people who followed Muhammad as the spiritual leader. And there's been a whole succession of them. Well, one of the things that the Ottomans acquired early on in their conquest was the title of caliph.
Did they buy it?
All of these... Huh?
Did they buy it?
No, they conquered it. Oh. When they took over Egypt in the 16th century, there was a caliph there, the last of the Ayyubids, they were called, and they essentially pried it away from him.
Hmm.
They had actually claimed it for some time before, but once they had him and they persuaded him in order to transfer it to them, in 1517, Sultan Selim the First, Selim the Grim was his nickname.
He
earned it for good reason. He also became Caliph of Islam, the Prince of the Faithful. And that gave him beyond. I mean, this is another dimension. It meant that he and all of his succeeding sultans, beyond simply being the emperors of this huge empire we've described, could, as caliph, claim to be the spiritual leader of all Muslims everywhere in the world.
So this was a true theocracy.
Yes, it was a spiritual title that gave them this power, at least in theory, over all Muslims around the world, beyond even those that live within their empire. So you've got, we're talking before we left off about the last sultan in any real sense that ruled as a sultan was this guy Abdul Hamid, the Red Sultan. And he earned that name not because, let's say, of any political tendencies, but because of his bloodletting. He was a very tough guy, and he had to be a tough guy. I mean, he was ruling this dying empire, and he had rebellions everywhere and plots within his military. And so he had a lot of people killed. But the other thing he was is that he was a very canny politician. And one of the things that he did during his reign is that he tried to buy favor with foreign powers, such as the British, not surprisingly, by using his power as caliph. So, for instance, the British ruled India, which at that time included everything as today Pakistan. So, while India was mostly Hindu, it included a very large Muslim population. And Abdul Hamid, twice during his reign, in the role of caliph of Islam, sent messages to the Indian Muslims saying, you should be loyal subjects of the British Raj. You should help the British rule India.
Hmm.
You should obey them, you know, even if they are infidels. Nevertheless, I, as caliph, give you permission to serve them. But there's even an American element to this. Because in 1898, same period, there was a Spanish-American War. And as a result of the Spanish-American War, as I guess everybody used to know in American schools, acquired the Philippines, the Philippine Islands. And then, you know, there was a rebellion, and there was a rebellion, which is still, if you look at the Philippines today, there is a Muslim rebellion in the South.
Remember the name.
There is a Moro rebellion in Mindanao, in the southern Philippines. It's been going on.
For decades.
For decades. And this was one of the things that the Americans, in occupying the Philippines, were concerned about this Muslim uprising. And the American ambassador approached Abdul Hamid and said, could you, as caliph, sort of tell the Muslims and the Moros to, you know, cool it? And he did.
Mm.
Again, you should essentially assist. That didn't work for long, because eventually the Moros did rebel. But he actually, initially, the Moros were supportive of the American takeover from Spain, in part because their caliph, their spiritual leader, far, far away in Constantinople, had told them this is what they were supposed to do.
It's a very interesting parallel between the Pope and the Catholics all over the world.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, you could make that parallel. His spiritual authority was not exactly, but similar to that which the Pope would tell what Catholics should do, and they were supposed to follow his direction. But what this suggests is that while the power of the Ottoman Empire and of the Sultan and the Caliphate wasn't what it used to be, nevertheless, it actually had some influence, that his word, that this ruler in faraway Constantinople, today Istanbul, could give a command or make a suggestion, whichever you want to see it, to Moro tribesmen and their leaders far away in the Philippines, and they would follow his direction. So it wasn't a completely empty thing.
Well, in this sense, the sultan slash caliph, obviously, caliph, what's the correct pronunciation?
Khalifa would be there. Khalifa, okay. Khalif, we'll call him the caliph.
Discovered, you know, remember when Hitler said about the Pope, you know, how many divisions does he have?
Mm-hmm.
In some contest that I forget what the substance was. Well, it seems to me that the Ottomans learned that spiritual power, actually, when your armies are failing and your navy is sinking, is a real good thing to have.
It can be. So Abdulhamid gets overthrown by a revolution on 1908. First, nobody really likes him. He's burned too many bridges. But it's a thing called the Young Turk Revolution, and that's a whole kind of topic into itself. So let's just say that it essentially was a military coup d'etat carried out by reform-minded nationalist military officers. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Who had formulated these plots in Masonic lodges. Okay.
Hmm.
I mean, not all of them were Freemasons, but they used the Masonic lodges to do this, and for the simple reason that you could go, you knew it was a controlled access. You only admitted people as members you trusted, and you could speak in secrecy.
Hmm.
Therefore, whatever it was intended to be, it becomes a perfect petri dish in order to grow a revolution. So they overthrew him, and so these nationalists, they had a great name. They didn't call themselves the Young Turks, really. They called themselves the Committee of Union and Progress. Now, who can object to union and progress?
Hmm.
And their idea was that they were going to revitalize the empire and modernize it. But what eventually happened is that they become a military junta that carries out the first mass genocide in modern history.
Just in case somebody else missed what I kind of missed while I was thinking about what you just said, the parallel, of course, is to the Masonic Petri dish which gave rise to the American Revolution.
Yeah. I mean, it's the thing that, this again is another topic, the Freemasons are continually accused of, and the Pope would accuse them of this, of being somehow disloyal, and he did on a number of occasions, and of plotting revolutions, and you'll always get the other idea, well, there are two things you never discuss in a lodge, you never discuss religion, you never discuss politics. Well, that's not what you're supposed to do, but, you know, we always know there's two ways in which the world actually works. There's what's in the rule books, and then there's what people actually do. And it's pretty hard if most of the members of your lodge or club or whatever it is all tend to share similar opinions to not talk about that. I mean, even if you leave the lodge and go to a bar and talk about it, it's still the kind of meeting place. And, you know, when you have something in which, from sheer practicality, in which you control the admission of members, that is, you pick like-minded people, basically. You know, you don't let people in who aren't going to fit in. And you then meet in a system of mutual secrecy and security. Because one of the things that you always swear in any organization of this kind is you keep your mouth shut about what happens inside. So whether it's intended or not, it is almost inevitable that if there's a political current going on, and, you know, you'll get arrested or executed if you talk about it outside the lodge, that's the only place you can carry it out. And it therefore becomes the perfect and really the only available place to plot your coup d'etat.
Well, people who get together for ostensibly another reason and have a secret conversation.
Right. I mean, it's one of those things that the atmosphere of fellowship and secrecy and like-mindedness.
Mm.
Okay, once you begin to put that together, all kinds of things, the law of unintended consequences can emerge. So the Young Turks, this military junta, controlled by three men, the three pashas.
And what year are we talking now?
We're talking about 1908, 1909.
Okay.
Is when they take control. And they still have a revolution. They replace Abdulhamid with a puppet sultan.
The Red Sultan is gone.
He's gone. And he's after him, the other sultans that follow him are no more than sort of factotums for this junta. The junta controls everything. They control the foreign policy and the internal policy. And they are really sort of modern guys. One of the things they are is that they are staunch Turkish nationalists. And, of course, that's kind of a problem in a multinational empire, because the Ottoman Empire has shrunk. I mean, it's lost its Balkan possessions in a couple of wars just before World War I called the Balkan Wars. And in that, former subject peoples, the Bulgarians, the Serbs, the Greeks, gang up on the Turks and drive them out of virtually all of Europe. So today, if you look at a map of Turkey and Europe, you'll see that there's Istanbul, and there's just a little tiny part of Turkey which is in Europe. That is all that remains of an Ottoman Empire, remember, that once stretched as far north as Budapest and beyond, all the way over to the Adriatic Sea. That included all of the Balkans. But that was the only thing that was left.
Don't forget North Africa.
But North Africa had slipped away. Egypt had gone.
Yeah, but I mean, British, that's how big the empire had been. It's now shrunken to a postage stamp.
But it's still pretty big. So what the empire consists of by World War One is Turkey, what would be Turkey today, and the Middle East. That's it. It's now been sort of confined to those areas. Still controls most of the Arabian Peninsula, still controls Iraq and Syria.
Maybe a third of its size when it was largest.
Yeah, maybe it has lost much of its hair. A third of its size would probably be a rough approximation. But within that shrunken empire, there are Turks are only about half the population. The other half of the population is made up of Arabs, and it's made up of Armenians and Greeks. And the Armenian and Kurds, by the way, which we hear a lot about in the news. And the Kurds are a people sort of more akin to Persians and Iranians. They're not Arabs and they're not Turks. It's very important to keep in mind. And that also is something that listeners, Turks are not a variety of Arab. Okay, that is not a mistake that you want to make. And Kurds are neither Turks nor Arabs, but a people separate from that. The Armenians were a very numerous population. The Armenians, by the way, are Christians. So are the Greeks within the empire. So while most of its subjects are Muslims, there are Christians. There are Christian Arabs in Lebanon. But the Armenians were a people, about 2 million of them, who lived in what would now be eastern Turkey and eastern Anatolia.
And just to be clear, the thing you said the last time was if Muslims rule, Their codices of rule is very beneficial to the diverse cultures and religions that they rule over, provided they're in the driver's seat.
Yes, the political power is always in the hands of Muslims. It must be. That's one of there's no possibility in the Ottoman Empire that the Sultan could be a Christian or a Jew or anything else.
Okay, just to be clear as backstory for what's coming.
Right. But keep in mind that, of course, he's also the Khalif, so how could he be other than that?
Anything else but, yes.
And this was, there's always this kind of historical debate. I mean, you can argue that the Ottomans as imperial rulers, on the whole, weren't that bad as imperial rulers go. And that's probably fair to say. On the other hand, they also weren't really that good at it either, because they managed to alienate virtually every non-Turkish nationality that lived within the empire. Everybody turns on them. I mean, for those of your listeners who've seen Lawrence of Arabia, the film, the highly fictionalized version of what happened, notice in that the Arabs are rebelling against the Turks. Well, that's what's coming. Everybody turns on the empire.
Hell of a good movie, though.
But one of the reasons why all these people turn on the empire is that this military junta, these young Turks, nationalist officers who were leading the empire, are fixated on turning it into a Turkish empire, and therefore the peoples who live in it either need to be Turkified or you need to get rid of them. And therefore, in the course of the First World War, which they join on the side of Germany, hoping that they'll be on the winning side, it can repudiate their debts and rebuild their power, they carry out a systematic mass murder of the Armenians in eastern Anatolia. That, by the way, what I just said there would probably get me arrested in Turkey today. Because that is verboten to discuss. Because officially, it never happened.
Do you know where I first heard that? And I think we touched on this on your first appearance. The first person who told me this, and he told it to me in an NBC network television show set three centuries in the future, was Gene Roddenberry. The major public discussion of what happened to the Armenians, the slaughter of the Armenians, like the Holocaust, you know, much later, was remembered by Roddenberry as the rock basis of the Prime Directive, the Non-Interference Directive. It's very interesting how he wove those stories together.
Huh. That is fascinating. Well, you know, Hitler made a comment about the Armenians, basically saying that, well, wasn't anybody going to complain about anything that happened to the Jews? Because, well, look what the Turks did to the Armenians, and nobody today remembers that. And he's talking about the 1930s. It is an extremely controversial issue, and it's one of those that there's great pressure in Turkey. I have to admit, there are people working there to try to bring this in the open and actually have a dialogue about it. But in essence, much of the Armenian population in Anatolia is destroyed. What you see today in the very small little country of Armenia that borders Turkey, one of the reasons, if you wonder why they're so hostile to each other and the border is closed, well, that's why.
They have a history.
There's a history, and that's simply the remnant of what was a much larger Armenian territory.
How many did the junta manage to kill?
A million at least, maybe a million and a half.
Gosh.
It's very difficult to calculate the whole. I mean, the general story is that, yeah, there used to be a lot more Armenians here, and then they all wandered off somewhere and died, or, you know, they went to California or something. I mean, that's... The efforts to deny this range from, I've even had people, you know, try to deny that there were ever Armenians there to begin with, or if they did, they all left of their own free will.
That sounds curiously parallel to some other deniers.
Yes, and so, yeah, you know, they apparently got tired and they left. but no, they were deliberately and systematically murdered.
So this was the first example of ethnic cleansing.
And you can simply go back and look at this wasn't unknown at the time. It's widely reported in the press. You can look at American newspapers, and they carry report after report about the massacre, the organized massacre of Armenians.
I guarantee
you.
But
it was all kind of quietly forgotten after the war.
The first exposure for most Americans in the mid-late 60s to the Armenian problem was Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek.
Huh. Well, there we go. Another milestone. So the quick and sort of dirty version of the Ottoman experience in World War I is that they pick the losing side. There's a lot of shooting and they're defeated.
Okay, that's a 30-second summary.
There they go. They put up a fight, but they are outgunned and they are defeated primarily by the British. And see, the British felt in many ways very betrayed by the fact that the Ottomans, who had owed them lots of money and who they'd kept on life support for decades, had turned on them.
Pick the other side.
Pick the other side. And also the British by this time had the big interest in India. Everything revolved around India. They don't call it the jewel and the crown for nothing. And then, of course, the British also controlled Egypt, and they also had oil interests in Persia. And they wanted to control the rest of the oil in that area. So they had territorial interests over most of the Arab lands. That's where Lawrence of Arabia comes in. Here's a this is why, if you ever wondered, a British officer was leading the Arabs in revolt against the Turks. Was this because the British Empire, again, were humanitarians and philanthropists who just wanted to help the Arabs? Well,
picking up their white man's burden.
They wanted the Arabs to kill as many Turks as possible so that the British could then assume political control of the territories, which they did. And this is eventually how Iraq is created and how this thing called the Palestine Mandate is created.
Yeah, talk about the lines on the map that mean nothing to the people on the ground.
Right. And you woke up, you know, someone put it, I woke up one morning and my grandparents were foreigners. Because someone had, that actually referred to, you know, post-World War I changes in Europe. But it works just as well in the Middle East. One day there was this thing called the Ottoman Empire, and if you lived in Baghdad, you lived in the Ottoman Empire. If you lived in Damascus, if you lived in Jerusalem, you lived in the Ottoman Empire. And then suddenly you find out that, well, you don't anymore. If you live in Jerusalem, you're in this thing called the Mandate of Palestine that the British control. If you live in Damascus, you're in this thing called the Mandate of Syria that the French occupy. And if you live in Baghdad, you're now in this thing called Iraq, which again the British controlled and put a king in control of. And so these are sort of artificial countries that were created. So the net impact is that while the Young Turks wanted to save the empire, as so many people do, they ended up destroying it. They were the final sort of, this is when it was finally killed off as any kind of functional state.
Let's take a small detour here and explore momentarily Farrell's contention, which was that World War One and the collapse of the Ottoman Empire created a situation where an Islamic Reformation, in parallel to the Christian Reformation, could not take place on the natural timetable that it was moving toward at that time. And that's how we got this kind of suspended bifurcation of Islam that we're currently dealing with, because that process never was allowed to go to completion, and we're kind of like stuck in mid-process.
Well, there's...
And if Joseph calls in and tells me I really botched that, you know, I apologize.
No. It's a complicated question, but there's a point in what he's saying in that, remember, the Sultan, which was, you know, he was turned into a puppet by the Young Turks, but when the Young Turks are defeated and they all flee, well, suddenly the Sultan's there, and when the Allies make peace with the Ottomans in 1918, when they sign an armistice, they sign it with the Sultan, and they keep him in power.
Who's also a caliph.
But he's also the caliph. Now, events unfold in that what eventually happens is that the Sultan doesn't retain power. Instead, you get the rise of a military dictator, a fellow that some people, maybe if you've ever heard of a Turkish ruler, you've probably heard of Kemal Atatürk.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Guy who started off life named Mustafa Kemal Pasha, before Turks had last names. And he then named himself, because one of the things he proclaimed as the new modern dictator was that all Turks would take surnames. It was by his command that this happened, as many things. It was by his command that they stopped using the Arab alphabet, and they began writing in the modern Turkish alphabet. So Atatürk was a soldier who had, in fact, he was connected to the Young Turks. He had fought bravely in World War One. He had become a military hero, and then when the war was over, he also fought an attempt by the Greeks to reclaim territory, a war which ended in the early 1920s with, by the way, the expulsion of all the Greeks from Anatolia.
Hmm.
So 1.5 million Greeks were expelled. Now, one of the things that meant is that by the time all these territories have been divided up, the Arab territories are split away and taken over by the British and the French, right?
Right.
The Armenians have been killed or driven out, and then the Greeks are killed or driven out. And so that means in what remained, what became the Republic of Turkey, ruled by Atatürk, there are only two ethnic groups that remain. The Turks, that are now the majority, and the Kurds.
Mm.
Which, by the way, Atatürk and his government refused to acknowledge their existence. Under Atatürk, there were no Kurds in Turkey. There were mountain Turks.
Mm.
You know, there were sort of backward people who lived up in the hills and didn't speak Turkish just because, apparently, they hadn't been schooled properly. And so there was a whole denial that the Kurds that were there. So this is something we may get down to. But if you look at the situation today, you'll notice that the Turks are very concerned about the Kurds.
Incredibly.
And the Kurds have no love for the Turks. Well, this didn't happen yesterday.
No.
The whole history of the Turkish Republic has been one of the suppression and the Kurds, the denial of their existence. And I'm not stating this from the standpoint of a great champion of the Kurdish cause. I'm not a champion of their cause. That's just the historical fact. They were there. They were included in a state which didn't recognize them, and they've always been second-class citizens, and that's why they're kind of unhappy. And that's why, also, they constitute today about 20% of Turkey's population.
Hmm.
And most of those areas, if you look at a map of Turkey and you look at those areas to the north of Syria and Iraq, well, you know who lives south of the border? Kurds. In Syria, all the areas in northern Syria along the Turkish border are largely inhabited by Kurds. And in Iraq, there's an autonomous Turkish area. And who lives on the other side in Turkey? More Kurds. So one of the things that your listeners could do is Google Kurdistan and look at a map of the territory that the Kurds inhabit and claim, and look how much of Turkey that includes. And then you'll understand why the Turks are bound and determined to suppress Kurdish nationalism and are deathly afraid of any kind of independent Kurdish entity along their border.
And so why this politically has halted our efforts to help the Kurds defeat ISIS, et cetera, because the support that we keep promising somehow doesn't appear, and it looks as if it's because of trying to keep relations with Turkey.
Well, a few months back, there was something in the news. There was a battle for Kobani. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
It was this border town in northern Syria, and it was right on the directly on the Turkish border, and it was a kind of last bastion the Kurds held in that, and ISIS was throwing at everything that they could, and they were determined to take that town. And this battle went on for weeks. The Kurds were eventually successful. They were not successful because the Turks in any way assisted them. They did not. Okay. What the Turkish military did was to largely sit across the border and watch the battle going on, because at the least, what they were watching was a battle in which two forces, one of which they knew they hated and feared, the Kurds, and one of which, you know, they weren't too crazy about, maybe, ISIS, were killing each other.
Mm.
So why on earth would they lift a finger to stop that? So they would sort of deliberately, there were also reports at the time, which I think probably have some credence to them, that ISIS fighters were moving through Turkish territory to attack Kurdish positions from behind. The Kurds claim this, and you can go back and find news stories where they did. But also, that ISIS fighters were being regularly treated in Turkish military hospitals and then returned to the fighting line.
Mm. Tell you what, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning, Dr. Richard Spence, we're discussing the convoluted and complex and mystifying to most of us Middle East, its history, and we're going to get to the future and what might be going on in the next few months. Next, here on the other side of midnight, my name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall be right back.
I'm turning in the street, turning in the road. So many people turn their lives away. Standing strong as I can, so I don't want to shine for very long. Lord, I guess I gotta give.
And we are back on the other side of midnight. Dr. Spence, please continue.
Well, I want to go back. We were sort of getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, I think, in talking about the Kurds and modern. But, you know, but it's always worthwhile to go back and forth in time, because it doesn't have to be linear. But go back to that question you said that, or the issue that Dr.
Yeah, how World War One and the collapse of the Ottomans basically halted the Islamic Revolution.
How that affected Islam.
Yeah.
Well, okay, remember that the Ottoman Sultan, he's also the Caliph of Islam. He's the Islamic Pope, for lack of a better term. So when the empire falls, this leaves in limbo the whole. In other words, one of the things that Ataturk, this military dictator who takes over and forms the republic, remember today where Turkey is a republic, not an empire, is that he abolishes in 1922 the empire and the sultanate. But that still leaves, When there is the very one last is a guy named Abdulmajid II, for anybody who wants to know. He was the last sultan and the last caliph within this line that went back to 1517. So when he's stripped of his title of sultan, well, he still has the title of caliph. And 2 years later, in 1924, Ataturk abolishes the caliphate. Now, this raised a number of questions. One,
did he have the power to do that?
Right. I mean, if you were a good Muslim, you would ask, how does this guy, this Turkish general who's proclaimed himself president of this thing called the Turkish Republic, how does he have the power to tell us that our spirit, that the Prince of the Faithful is no longer the Prince of the Faithful? Well, clearly, religiously, he has no such power, but nevertheless, he did.
Do we know why he did it? what his rationale
because
was?
He was determined to completely transform Turkey into what he wanted. He wanted it to become a modern European country.
Okay.
Ataturk personally, in his personal beliefs, was an atheist. He made no real. He was not a practicing Muslim. He could care less about it.
He was an atheistic caliph.
No, Ataturk is the
yeah, but
the
I thought he was the last caliph.
No. He is Abdul Majid was the last sultan and last caliph.
Oh, okay. I see.
And
okay.
First, what Ataturk? These people's names all begin with A. But what? What Kemal Ataturk did was first to abolish the empire and the sultanate, and then 2 years later, in 1924, he also abolished the caliphate. Now, that was something, again, that as a political leader, Muslims might ask, how did he have the power to do it? But nonetheless, he did. And what it did is that it meant that the line of caliphs, remember, that had existed in one form or another since the 7th century, since the time of Muhammad, there had always been someone, sometimes more than one, who claimed to be caliph, was now dead.
At the hands of a political general
At the hands of a nationalist nation builder who was now determined to change the entire character of his country and to try to, you know, Ataturk at one point, if he thought if he could have eradicated Islam completely or any religion from Turkish life, he would have done so. But he basically left the religion. That was what people practiced. But he destroyed the foundations. He disestablished. Now, this is something, again, that Westerners look upon very favorably. The idea that, well, he separated church and state. Indeed, he did. But what happens in the process of that is that you also destroy institutions, and you destroy a whole kind of power structure that people were used to. And keep in mind that there had always been somewhere in the world for centuries and centuries and centuries a caliph, something which Muslims around the world could look to as a spiritual guide. Now, that spiritual guide might have been wrong or corrupt or, like, you know, the Red Sultan we were talking about, exploiting his power for political purposes, but it was there.
And don't forget all the corrupt popes we found out about.
Right, and corrupt popes, but still there was a pope, and you could always hope for another one. But sort of try to imagine Catholicism functioning with the papacy abolished.
Okay.
Where is the authority?
Mm.
And that is where the situation has existed since 1924. So what ISIS is claiming and trying to
restore. So this is why Farrell says this was really an interruptus in progress.
Well, I may be sort of, that's the way I'm sort of interpreting what you're saying. There may be more to that, but I think that's what I would see is the connection that he's making, that the sense, the only thing that existed in the form of a kind of generally recognized spiritual authority, keep in mind just in Sunni Islam, the Shiites paid no attention to him, but within that, it was gone, and there was therefore no single voice which could speak for that. And the argument that you could make, I wouldn't insist upon it, but I think an argument you could make is that would it have been possible for the kind of extremism that has developed, which has given rise to what we tend to think of as militant Islam or jihadism, could jihadism, as what it is today, have developed in a climate in which there was a caliphate, in which there was a spiritual authority that said, yes, this you can do, this you cannot do.
I think Joseph's position
is
no. It would be like looking at the, again, being a Roman Catholic, I can say this, at Catholicism without the papacy, without the Vatican, with basically parish priests and, you know, bishops and an infrastructure at the very local level, but everybody has the same voice. No one can claim to be the spiritual voice that everyone else looks to. And under those conditions, it's like chaos.
Well, you know, it allows some guy who calls himself Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi to get out of an American jail in Iraq and in a few years proclaim himself caliph. Okay? The only way he can do that is that there's no other caliph to say, no, you're not.
And there isn't. And
it destroyed anything that remained of a kind of institutional legitimacy within Islam. And it sort of turned over the Middle East. I mean, Ataturk, this the founder of modern Turkey, and he made himself a kind of virtual god in Turkey. His picture, if you go there, is everywhere.
Still?
Still. It's also, it was until fairly recently, a crime to deface his picture in any way. And something which tourists should be aware of. There was, certainly the current regime is trying to de-Ataturk, is really trying to reverse his westernization revolution in some degrees. But Ataturk was, he's the classic Middle Eastern military dictator. He's the guy that Nasser and Gaddafi and the Assads model themselves on. Whether they admit it or not, he is the model for every military, secular, reformist army officer, even Saddam Hussein.
I was just going to say, Hussein fits the mold perfectly.
Right. They all are little Ataturks. They all try to follow in here.
Except with Hussein, he connected his personal lineage through what? Reincarnation all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar. He thought himself a reincarnation of the glories of Sumer, of Assyria, of Babylon, of old?
Well, it was trying to, you can see some of this in Egypt as well, the idea of trying to sort of, I mean, all of these areas had a history, a huge history that predated Islam, and Islam comes along pretty. Now, it came along in the 7th century, and clearly there was lots of stuff going on in Egypt and in Mesopotamia for thousands of years before that. And so one of the things that Saddam Hussein and other rulers would attempt to do was to connect themselves to a kind of broader historical model. But I think part of that is that they didn't, being secularists, they didn't want to base their power and national identity on Islam, because Islam isn't national. That is, it's not something, if you wanted to build up, you know, an Iraqi national identity, if you want to build a Turkish national identity, you can't do that on Islam, because Islam has no national identity. It is a very ecumenical religion. It's one that transcends any kind of national or ethnic or racial boundaries. And that doesn't help you when you want to build a national state. And they very often find that just the kind of Muslim or Islamic narrative isn't really useful in that respect. And that, again, is why jihadis, those that want to recreate the caliphate, hate those regimes. That's why they hate Assad. Because Assad is not only a Shiite, which makes him contemptible, he is also a representative of the very secularist, westernizing political national leadership they despise.
Well, he went to school at, what, Oxford?
Well, somewhere in the West. I mean, he's very well, I mean, he's a thoroughly westernized figure.
I think he was trained as a dentist or an optician or something.
Yeah. And
so he's thoroughly, thoroughly westernized, and he represents almost like an alien invader in the midst of the Syrian people. Or some of the people.
One, he's a member of Syria. The predominant element there are Sunni Muslims. I mean, there are Christians, and there are other groups as well. But then he is a member of another constituent but minority group called the Alawites. And the Alawites are another one of these numerous Shiite sects. They are a subgroup of Shiism.
Like the Mamluks, maybe?
No, the Mamluks were kind of a military aristocracy.
Okay.
I know this gets confusing.
Well, these subcultures are part of what makes the Middle East impenetrable to any Western analysis by people who have no time to basically take a crash course.
Yeah. I mean, one way to think of it is that the Middle East is an area where civilization has had the longest period to do its damage. Therefore, one of the things that, you know, they always argue that, I object to the criticism that the problem in the Middle East exists because people there are uncivilized. That is not the case at all.
No, of course
they
not.
This is where civilization as we know it began. Yep. It's not too little civilization. I'd argue it's too much. And it is centuries and it is millennia of groups coming and going and religions forming and combining and breaking apart, of incessant ethnic and religious struggles that go on. And it's one of the things that looking at the outside is often sort of mystifying for people, and why I keep wanting to reemphasize this point. Nothing there started yesterday. everything is a reference to something in the past, and it may be something that goes back 70 years, it may be something that goes back 700 years, it may be something that goes back 7,000 years, but everything is a reference to the past, and all of these things build on each other.
So is that one of the reasons why ISIS is trying to destroy icons of the past, to eliminate the power of the past?
To erase anything which isn't part of an Islamic past.
Prior to Islam, yeah.
Yeah, the idea is that anything which is not Islamic, anything which is not derived from the Quran or the Hadith, which is not consistent with Sharia law, remember, any law which is, you know, you need no laws except what's in the Sharia, because they're either redundant or they're unacceptable.
Hmm.
And therefore, you don't need all of these monuments of past heathen civilizations are worthless. The argument would be is that they contribute. By the way, this was an argument that had been used in Christendom and elsewhere that never put into practice in any significant role. But the concept that the works of pagan minds there's nothing we can learn from them. And therefore, all of that history should be obliterated.
Isn't that kind of the position of the Inquisition vis-a-vis the New World and the Spanish and what they did with all the manuscripts?
Well, you can see that in the treatment often of, say, native populations in the Americas in terms of their religions and practices. You know, the idea of tearing down a temple and building a church on it. That's a very powerful statement when you do that. When you tear down someone's existing place of worship, you tear down their temple and you destroy the monument to their gods, and you build a new monument directly on top of it to the new god. And that is a very powerful way of sending a message that the old order, the old gods are dead, and our gods reign supreme where they did. So you'd better get in line and worship them. And the thing is that often works. In fact, it works tremendously well. But it is this, and it's this urge. I mean, I don't think what you see in ISIS is something that you can't find examples of elsewhere, but it is this focus of the idea that there is an absolute truth, and anything which is not part of that shouldn't just be ignored, but should actually be destroyed. And so destroying monuments in Palmyra, I think there's actually two reasons they do that. One is this ideological idea that we want to obliterate the non-Islamic past. And the other, I think, is that, one, they know that it gets them attention, and it will be reported in the West and elsewhere, and it will be another thing that will generate horror and fear.
And attraction for a certain group that want...
And attraction for a certain number of people. But it's when you carry out mass beheadings, and you make rather well-produced videos, and you release them on the web, you are proud of what you're... I mean, they are doing this for a deliberate psychological... They are waging psychological warfare against you.
Well, they're waging psychological warfare against what they hope will be the final crusade from the West to get rid of them, and the final battle of Armageddon somewhere there in Syria.
Well, if they really believe their stuff, of course, they believe that God is on their side, and it doesn't matter.
Which, of course, is why I called you, because when the Turks shot down a Russian military aircraft that was engaged in counter something or other, we're not quite sure which group they were bombing that morning, it really looks like this small group, which somehow has taken a lot of territory in a very short period of time, and seems to have very interesting allies, up to and including the son of the current president of Turkey, who is arranged, if you go to our second link in Radio with Pictures tonight, there's a very interesting article, which I sent Richard earlier, relating to how ISIS has been funded in large part through the good offices of the son of the current president of Turkey, Erdogan.
Yeah, his son is Bilal Erdogan, and one of the things he owns is a shipping line. In fact, he owns a number of shipping lines, which are excellent for moving merchandise around, including oil. And what he's specifically accused of, and which I suspect is probably quite a fair accusation, is doing business with the Islamic State in marketing the oil that they produce in their territory. Now, there are a couple of things that are indisputable. One, they have oil in their territory. They are actively engaged in producing it and shipping it out. So where does it go? Here again, you can look at a map. Where are they going to ship their oil to? Well, you know, they can't really ship it to the coast in Syria because they don't control that. They don't have any access to any ports there. In fact, if you look at their territory they control, they don't have access to any ports. And the one place where what the Russians accuse them of, and I think in this case the Russians are quite right, is that it's essentially passing through Turkey. The same way, I mean, consider this.
Well, the oil is flowing out through Turkey, and the volunteers, they're
flowing in.
Exactly, through Turkey.
Right. So the way you join ISIS, okay, any recruiter could tell you in Frankfurt or somewhere else, is that if you're recruited in Europe or Canada or wherever it is, you get into Syria and join the Islamic State through Turkey. Now, don't you think that Turkey, that has a large military and very closely guarded borders, wouldn't notice that and couldn't cut that off or choke it off and has made no actual effort to do so? People flow like a river through Turkey.
And Turkey is supposed to be a member of NATO.
That are coming out, that are a member of the... Now, they are a member of NATO. So are the Greeks. And the Turks, I think, in 2014 violated Greek airspace, according to the Greeks, over 2,000 times.
Hmm.
None of their planes, they seem to be past masters at that. The thing is that overflying a border, particularly, is, you know, it happens. It happens a lot. It's one of those things that is, not unusual, and it's not one of those things that you normally shoot somebody down for. You intercept them, you warn them out of your territory, but unless you would have some reason to believe that that aircraft actually intended to do some harm to you, you don't shoot them down.
Not anymore.
No, that would generally be that would be considered in some places to be an act of war.
Well, yeah, and this was obviously a statement, and the analysis that I've seen now says that Turkey actually planned this. This wasn't a spur of the moment.
It was deliberate. I think two things were probably at work there. One, the Turks intended to do that. The Russians didn't suspect that they would.
Really? Putin wasn't on his guard about someone like Erdogan, who's been very curious in this situation?
It probably had more to do with the Russian planes had been flying a lot of sorties in that area. And the Turkish F-16s patrolled the border airspace. So seeing Turkish fighters wasn't unusual, and it wasn't unusual for them to come in close and possibly shepherd you, you know, move in, tell you you're over the border and elsewhere. And that is one of those things that became kind of routine. And the way they were able to pull this off, I would suspect, is that there was complacency on the part of the Russians in the Su-24. They really had no reason, and there wasn't any reason to believe that the Turks would shoot them down. There wasn't.
Hmm.
Straying over the border was not any real, that's not something you would be shot down for. And therefore, not fearing anything about that and not looking over it, the F-16s got in pretty close and let go, and that's what happened. Also, there doesn't seem to be much dispute that the missile struck the Russian plane when it had returned over Syrian territory, and that the missile had been fired toward Syria, which is also something, by the way, you want to avoid, because you're then firing weapons into another country. So it was deliberate, and part of the reason, this is where you get into the arguments that, well, one of the things the Turks were very, the reason that they overreacted, or they reacted as they did in this case, was because the Russians were intruding on the shipment, this clandestine, or really not so clandestine, shipment of oil across the Syrian border into Turkey.
Oh, that's right. They were supposed to be taking out the convoys.
Yeah. The other thing, though, is that if you pay close attention to many of the news reports, you'll notice that the Turks also were quite upset that the Russians at this point were bombing an anti-Assad rebel group that was composed of Turkmen, T-U-R-K-M-E-N. And the Turkmens are not Turks, but they are Turkish. That is, they are a kindred Turkic people. And here's one of those things that Turks or Turkic peoples come in many varieties, of which the Turks in Turkey are only one. And therefore, across the border in Syria, there are, in addition to all these other groups we've talked about, it's like a crazy quilt, there are groups of Turkmen. And these guys aren't Kurds, and they're not Arabs, and they're not even technically Turks, but they are Turkish, they are ethnic cousins. And the Turkmen, the area they were fighting in was a thing called the Jabal al-Turkmen, the Mountain of the Turkmen. And that's because all the villages around there are that. And the Russians were pounding them. And that, I think...
Because they're in opposition to Assad.
They're in opposition to Assad.
And the Russians want to prop up Assad at all costs.
The Russians are there... The Russians are bombing ISIS, but they're bombing anybody who's fighting Assad. Okay, Assad's their boy, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy they're backing. And their job is to keep him in power and to assist the Syrian army, and they will bomb anybody who opposes him.
So if Erdogan is actually secretly and not so secretly funding ISIS through facilitating oil, because oil on the open market gets you a lot of cash, and cash is what fuels wars and buys off people, and you know, you basically can't have a civilization without a lot of cash flow. So why, if that's the choke point, why have not we or the Russians or all of us basically said to Turkey, look, this is not the way a NATO member behaves. This is not the way you're going to lead us into World War III. Because look, the Russian military now apparently has cut off all communication with the Turkish military.
Yeah.
And so the next incident could involve nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, like Khrushchev put into Cuba during the Russian missile crisis.
Well, if I was a Turkish pilot flying patrol along the border, I would be extremely careful. Because the Russians, at some point, will almost certainly exact revenge about this, but they'll take their time doing it. So there's going to be... But, you see, the thing with these... this goes back to things like how World War I started, you know?
Mm.
A particular Grand Duke gets shot in Sarajevo. It's between Serbia and Austria-Hungary, two countries, well, one still exists. And then how suddenly does everybody else get involved in this? Well, because that's the way things happen, folks. Events can take on, it's the law of unintended consequences.
Yep.
That if you do something that you think will have this effect and you unleash a cavalcade of things that you can't control.
See, the problem I'm seeing here is if you have a bunch of crazies, ISIS, fundamentalist Islamics, who basically feel it's their job, their duty to bring on the end of the world in this part of the world, they've set themselves up perfectly with a nation which can do it a la Turkey.
The Turks, the question that comes in here is that, Erdogan's a politician. He's a fairly, he's a pretty canny guy.
So why is he pulling the tail of the Russian bear?
So why is he then? Well, because he thinks that he has NATO behind him. That's the main reason.
Oh.
He doesn't think that they can go too far. And the other question comes in, well, considering he's in NATO, why aren't all the other NATO members telling him to behave? Well, because they are afraid he might quit. I mean, Erdogan is exerting Turkish priority. This is the thing to keep in mind. He's not first and foremost a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He is first and foremost, in his own way, he is a Turkish nationalist, but he's a Turkish nationalist not like Atatürk, the military founder of the Republic, who I talked about earlier. Atatürk wanted to westernize Turkey. He wanted to disestablish Islam as a religion. Erdogan still wants Turkey economically to be part of Europe, wants to join the EU, but his party, the Justice Justice and Development Party, which doesn't sound like a religious
it's
party.
It's nice
it
to know that even professors have problems with remembering all this stuff.
Because before it was something else. So there was, I think it drew out of a thing called the welfare. But notice there are Islamic parties that don't call themselves the Islamic Party.
No.
Because that generally was kind of forbidden. Yeah, you weren't supposed to. But this is all against, so one of the things that his party is doing and what he wants to do is to return Islam to a center of Turkish life and identity. He wants to restore many of the kind of social prestige and cultural prestige which Islam had. The other thing that Erdogan is a big fan of is the Ottoman Empire.
How could I know?
He speaks quite fondly of the great Ottoman past.
Which is the perfect segue, Dr. Spence, into our last segment, where we're going to talk about a calendar and the correlations and the future that we hope is not in our future. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. My guest this morning, Dr. Richard Spence, we're trying to deconvolve the impossible, which is the Middle East and what's going on. We shall return.
I was thinking at the time you said you were my friend.
So interesting how that music written by my friend Nick Skouros and Chris has this Middle Eastern flavor, intriguing tonight. So we're basically poised, unfortunately, between a rock and a hard place, between this burgeoning caliphate that wants to bring on the end of the world, and the quickest way to do that is initiate a nuclear World War III. And you've got a guy as president of Turkey who basically wants to reinstate the Ottoman Empire and the resurgence of a caliphate. And then we have this weird thing that my friend Chris Knowles discovered last week, and which I sent to you, which is item number 3 in Radio with Pictures. It's this fascinating beginning work in progress of a calendar which correlates these terror attacks with interesting and seminal dates in the history of the Ottoman Empire, including its final collapse.
You sent this to me, and I have to admit that it was interesting enough that I completely dropped something that I was supposed to finish for tomorrow and spent my time playing around with it.
Oh, cool! Because I promised Chris that we would get you guys together. His schedule wouldn't permit him to be on, but I figured we'd start you on the calendar and you can flesh out, put flesh on the bones, because this many correlations going back to the beginning of the so-called War on Terror, September 11th, with the previous iteration of ISIS, which was Al-Qaeda, it seems that it's all revolving around this huge whirlpool in the Middle East, this empire that was almost as big as the Roman Empire, somewhat smaller than the British Empire, ruled the roost, and when it collapsed, an awful lot of bitter people apparently have very long memories, and a lot of that's going on now, Chris has been able to trace to these crucial dates.
Well, it goes back to something we said earlier, I guess at the beginning. The Ottoman Empire was a big deal for a long time.
Yeah, and this calendar shows that it is a big deal.
And when it disappeared, there was a vacuum of a kind created. The one that we were just talking about, there was a vacuum in authority of who was really in charge of Islam. And it changed. And it also meant, for instance, that when the Ottoman Empire disappeared, there was no longer any great Muslim state in the world. Instead, Muslims lived in now a lot of little states, which had basically been formed by infidels and which were more or less controlled by them, or ruled by people who apparently wanted to turn us into Westerners, someone like Ataturk. And these are the types of things that, if you look at the Islamic State, there's a lot of history, and there's a lot of frustration. There's of course degrees of fanaticism. They're all brought into this, but history is what shaped it. So the one thing that your friend Chris did with this is, the first thing he did, and I'd really commend him on, is that whatever the actual correlation here, he'd asked a very simple question. These events, these terrorist events, occur on specific days. Is there a significance to that day beyond simply that this event happened on it? That is, the event, you know, sometimes, I mean, inevitably, I guess you would have the idea that a terrorist event occurs because, well, that's the day that you had the C4 and everybody was ready, and that's when it launched, right? Because it's the day. So,
except that there's one thing we've learned about this new terrorism. When I say new, I'm going back to 2001. It seems to have a ritual basis. There were discussions I saw in the open literature and news reports about people looking at rituals, people looking at anniversary dates, but no one has really done the first cut that's so interesting to connect all this stuff to the Ottomans, which was this huge turning point in all of Islamic history.
Yeah, and beyond just the Ottomans, I mean, specific dates within Islamic history as well.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have an actual birth date for Muhammad, but we have an approximate date for his death. And so, anyway, I mean, it's one of the things, a day and an event, let's say, if a terrorist event occurs on a day, it could mean, and I'd even be willing to say that in most cases it may mean, that it just happened on that day because events came together. But there may be other factors involved, and since these are planned operations and the day was chosen, there is always the possibility you have to consider that that day was picked for a specific ritual meaning. And that's really what it comes down to.
Let me give you two specific examples. He's got September 11th marked, of course, 2001. That's the anniversary of the Great Siege of Malta. The Ottomans were defeated there in 1565, yes, according to his calendar. And then about 100 years later, give or take, in 1683, at the Battle of Vienna, the Ottomans were defeated. So they got a twofer.
It does correspond to... Now, remember, whenever you're talking about an Ottoman defeat, you're also talking about, what, a defeat of the Caliph, an Islamic defeat.
Yes, of course.
Because in its heyday, the Ottoman Empire is basically synonymous with the military power of Islam, because it was the only game in the Islamic world, for the most part. So it's something that you could look at this in two ways. Someone who is a kind of Turkish nationalist or is Turkish sentiment could see this as a date of a defeat of the Turkish Empire, but someone who is looking at it from purely a kind of religious standpoint could say this is also a day of a defeat for Islam. So, but there are other things on here. For instance, towards the top of it, you'll notice that there are three events that occur on January 7th.
Yeah, it's arranged from top to bottom chronologically in basically 1 year. January's the top,
yeah,
and the end of the year is at the bottom. And it's a partial list. There's a lot more that he wants to do with this.
Well, I can give them a couple of suggestions as to other ways you could take this. For instance, there's a completely other calendar that I think you would need to look at in this, and that's the Islamic calendar, which is a lunar calendar, keep in mind, which rotates around the solar calendar every 32. That is, any day on the Islamic lunar calendar over a period of 32 years will move completely around the solar calendar. So it's this always this kind of moving element in which they shift around. That makes it more difficult to calculate. But remember, every date in the Western calendar, every date in the Gregorian calendar that we're familiar with corresponds to some other moving date on an Islamic calendar.
That would be a fascinating correlation. And with computers, it's trivial to put these two together. I've got to get you and Chris talking to each other.
Yeah, that could do. But I think that you might really find some interesting correlations if you looked at that.
I just found one that's stunning. In the middle, in July, on July 16th, there was the attack on the Chattanooga Military Recruiting Center in 2011.
Yes.
That happens to be the date of the beginning of the Islamic calendar in 622. Now, it's two other dates you need to know about July 16th. July 16th was the date of Trinity. The particular first explosion of an atomic device a few miles from where I'm sitting tonight in this studio here in the Land of Enchantment. And July 16th was also the time NASA chose to launch at 3:32 a.m. Eastern Time that morning on July 16th, the Apollo 11 mission to the moon. And again, these are all dates which were specifically chosen.
Yeah, it's well, again, the January 7th sort of stood out to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the one thing that I noticed is that that is the Orthodox and Eastern Christian Christmas.
Hmm.
Because it, see, this gets even more complicated, because remember, historically, there have been lots of calendars used, and before there was the Gregorian calendar that came, you know, the one we use now that pretty much came into use around 1700, there was the Julian calendar, which the Russians and the Russian Orthodox Church and Eastern Christian churches, like the Coptic Christians in Egypt, still use. So those Coptic Christians who were killed in 2010 were killed on their Christmas.
Interesting.
I would suspect that was not coincidental. If nothing else, it explains why there would have been Coptic Christians sort of out and about on that particular day, or that they would have been gathered in a place. What that might, how that would necessarily relate to a car bomb in Yemen or the Charlie Hebdo attacks is less certain, but that day, in other words, what would appear at first glance to have no connection really is an important religious holiday, not an Islamic holiday, but in fact, the antithesis of an Islamic holiday.
Hmm.
But yeah, I think that you could find a, you know, I was trying to look for other dates that one might look for, things like the fall of Constantinople, the old capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, the real sort of jump-starting of the Ottoman Empire. That's on the 29th of May.
Okay.
That occurred. There's one event here, I think it is November 5th.
I see that.
And that's close. It's not exact, but it is close to November 2nd, which is the date on the Balfour Declaration.
Oh.
Which...
yeah, talk about Balfour. That's where the line's in the map,
Balfour
basically.
Balfour Declaration, not one of these things that occurred during World War One. It was written on the 2nd of November, 1917, by the British Foreign Secretary to Lord Walter Rothschild in London.
Hmm, there's a name
and
in history.
And what it was about is that it was a statement that the British were at this point invading Turkish Palestine. All right? So the war is on, and the British army is marching on Jerusalem. And one of the things that existed in Turkish Palestine at that time were some relatively small Jewish Zionist colonies, because the Turks had allowed Jews to settle there. So the first sort of Jewish settlement, Zionist settlements in Palestine, had taken place under the Turks. Now the question was, how are these Jewish settlers going to respond to the British military presence? Because they'd actually gotten along pretty well with the Turks, and therefore, are they going to be friendly, or are they going to be unfriendly? How do we treat? There was even an idea that maybe we should round them all up and put them in a concentration camp in Egypt. British thought about that. So the idea was here that Balfour is writing to Walter Rothschild. And who was Walter Rothschild? He's not in the British government. Instead, he was an important figure in the British Zionist organization, or the branch of the World Zionist Organization in Britain. So Balfour, representing the British war cabinet, he's relating a meeting that was taken, and he basically, it's a very short letter, and it just says that His Majesty's government, I think the key word, will look with favor upon the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine, once it's under our administration.
Hmm.
But he also quickly adds that, of course, this will do nothing to harm the property or rights of the indigenous inhabitants. They never quite worked that part out.
Nope.
But this is generally what's claimed to be the British promise to create a Jewish state. It does not say that. It says we will. Okay, you can parse this. What exactly does it mean when you say, we'll look with favor on the establishment of a homeland? All right. That leaves a lot of wiggle room. But nevertheless, this was to reassure. This was sent from the British government to the head of the Zionist organization in Britain, which would then be would be communicated more broadly, that the Zionist colonists, the Jewish colonists, in Palestine, under British administration, are safe, and that we will favor an expansion of it. Therefore, see, we're on your side. This was, you know, you can say this was another example of wartime expediency. All right?
Mm.
You're invading a territory. You want to make everybody is on your side, so you make vague promises to them that you'll worry about fulfilling later. Thus is history made.
Standard
but
politics.
That date, that's one of those things that, so November 5th is, not that close, but it's close enough to make me notice that and just to wonder if that's what they may have had in mind. Because that would certainly be a date that in other quarters would be more infamous from that standpoint.
Well, the London bombing on July 7th just stands out like the sore thumb. You know, the Crusaders lay siege to Jerusalem.
The First Crusade. I guess my only quibble there is that even in 1099, Jerusalem was largely a Christian city.
Okay.
It's one of those things that they kind of it certainly was controlled under Islamic political control, but. Yeah, one of the...
But isn't political control really the whole issue?
Yes. Although when the Crusaders, being rather desperate, stormed the city and slaughtered many of the people inside, they were either aware or not aware that they were killing Christians, mostly. Not their sort of Christians, keep in mind, but ones who were their co-religionists.
In one of the Crusades, or maybe I'm confusing the Crusades with what happened to the... the guys in the south of France, though. Come on. Can't
the
think.
Cathars?
Of, yeah, the Cathars.
Yeah.
The general who basically said, just kill them all. Let God sort it out.
That's the siege of Béziers.
Yeah. Okay.
Slay them all. God will know his own.
But it's the same philosophy.
It's the same. It's also an army that was at the end of its rope. The First Crusade is one of those things that really just should never have succeeded, but it did. It was kind of this wild adventure that, they had fought their way across hostile territory. They had finally arrived at this city of their dreams, which may not really have lived up to it, and are bound to capture it. But I'm not sure anybody took a census. Yeah, but much of the city, the population of the city was primarily Eastern Christians or Jews, although the forces defending it were under the local. The Arab Empire by that time had broken down. And in fact, one of the reasons why the Crusades started at that particular time and not earlier is that there was sort of chaos in the region. How surprising. And one of the things spreading that chaos was that as the old political order that had been established by the Arabs had broken apart, invasions of Turkish peoples were spreading war and chaos in the region. Hmm. And one of the things that did is that it cut off the access of Christian pilgrims to Jerusalem, which even under stable Islamic rule, they had been allowed to do. I mean, there had been a kind of deal which was made in terms of access to this city, which had religious significance for three different religions.
Because Islam ruled, and they could afford to be beneficent.
Yeah, and there's money to me, but there was a way of they would maintain political control. But part of this was really an effort. You have this. This sort of chaos created, and then people try to restore some kind of order. And that will often may generate more violence on its own. But that's why this happens at a particular time. That's connected to the 7th of July. Just above that, May 16th, the Sykes-Picot Treaty signed. Now, remember when I said earlier that the French took over, had drawn lines to create Syria, the British had created Iraq, and they had created Palestine. That's exactly the Sykes-Picot Treaty.
Hmm.
This was in 1916, when contrary to the vague British promises to the Arabs, which was that we're going to free you from the Turks and give it all to you, instead that the French and British had already made plans to divide the Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire among themselves.
Look at the date for the Paris attacks, a couple of weeks ago, November 13th. That's the date of the occupation of the Ottoman Empire by the French in 1918.
Mm-hmm.
And the Turks are now shooting down Russian airplanes in response to the French declaring their state of emergency. And all right, this goes back to Erdogan. And I keep tripping over the name because, you know, Erdogan is so close to the Dogon, which is the African tribe around Mali, that believe they have a connection to the star Sirius. And, of course, Isis is the Egyptian name for Sirius. And this rabbit hole is getting very deep very quickly, Richard.
Well, see, it's the type of thing that can give you, if you look at it long enough, you know, if you look at something long enough, you can see things in it. But there is, it's like the dates. And as I mentioned before, the date that something occurs may have no significance, or it may have tremendous significance. And one way to think of it is that every day on the calendar is loaded with historical significance.
It's somebody's birthday, somebody's anniversary, somebody died, somebody was born, whatever.
Something happened. If you went through it and sort of chronicled everything.
But these are not minor events. These are major. There must be a way statistically to actually make this robust, if you help, Chris, because this is, to me, the value of this, in the few minutes we've got left, is predictive. Science is nothing if it's not prediction. Suppose we could use this calendar matrix to actually map out where the next events might occur and what form they might take. You know, pattern recognition.
Well, yeah. It's going to be complicated because, again, you've got this other...
It's the Middle East. Complicated is its middle name.
It's complicated. You've got another calendar you need to bring into this.
Yep.
Which I think is probably the one that they would be looking at.
I would think so, yes.
But there are correspondences between them. But that doesn't mean that they wouldn't pick dates that would be significant. Remember, the goal here in terms of terror is to affect the psychology of the target.
Right.
And it goes back to this thing as to why they film beheadings. Because of the fact that they want to horrify their audience.
Yeah, or burn guys alive in cages. Or any, the most horrific things they can put on social media now, because as Obama said very rightly, they're brigands with a good social media game. And the social media game is crucial because they're after the hearts and minds of an awful lot of young, disturbed people that are looking for a cause bigger than themselves.
And in the other end, among those who they can't recruit, they want to terrify into submission.
Yep.
Now, the goal, ultimately, of this caliphate is to bring the whole world under the control of Islam. That doesn't necessarily mean forcibly converting everyone, but it means making everyone submit to Islam, because, remember, in their view, Sharia law, Islamic authority, the authority of the caliphate is the only legitimate religious and political authority. And therefore, in their view, they're doing everyone a favor by bringing them under the beneficent rule of Islam. Even non-Muslims, they argue, the Dini, will be better off under our control, because our control is divinely guided, than to leave them to the devilish practices that they have.
So what leads us to the naive question that I wanted to frame this whole show around, which is, what is Erdogan's game? If he wants to reestablish the Ottoman Empire, isn't that the caliphate that ISIS wants, and isn't the fact that his son is helping supply the crucial money that makes all this happen part of the connector that makes us look at this as this is how they might actually pull it off?
Well, that's the question. It's a difficult one to answer because there are two things at work here. You could say, does Erdogan really want to restore the Ottoman Empire, which is a lot of responsibility, or does he want to restore the caliphate?
Well, if Ataturk could dissolve it by just, you know, an edict, couldn't the current president of Turkey reinstate it by edict?
He could say, and well, from would he try it? I suspect he would, since he's pretty much tried everything. I mean, Erdogan is a guy who's willing to use, as I would read him, even though he is opposed to many of the things that Ataturk did in Turkey, and he wants to reverse them, he seems to be perfectly willing to use the same strong-arm methods. So one of the things that Erdogan did a few years back, remember, he's been either as prime minister or president of Turkey, he's been in control of the country for more than a decade, from around, his party won its first big election in 2002, and he became prime minister in 2003, and has been that consistently until he was elected president, even more powerful, in 2014. But well, he wants to use, he is, you know, anybody who criticizes him gets thrown in jail. The other thing he did is that he purged the Turkish military. You could go back and look. There were two trials in which large numbers of Turkish army officers were charged with treason or charged with other crimes, and there were mass court-martials of them.
Now, were
the Turkish army has always been loyal to
Were these secularists, or were they basically Islamic tendencies?
Most of them were, I think, what he was trying to get rid of were Ataturk loyalists. The Turkish army has viewed itself as the sort of guardian of the Ataturk legacy.
So he wants believers in the ranks.
Well, you look at it this way. The Turkish army intervened, overthrew the Turkish government in 1960. They overthrew the Turkish government in the 1970s. They overthrew the Turkish government in the 1980s. They even pulled off a thing, I forget the date, called coup by memorandum. And a coup by memorandum.
We have 30 seconds.
Instead of having a military coup, you just send a note to the government saying, we're going to have a coup, so why don't you resign before we do that?
I wish we had time. We only have a few seconds left. Richard, you've got to come back, because now we're at the point where what happens from here on, particularly between Turkey and Russia and between Putin and Obama, may decide the fate of the human race over the next several thousand years. That's how close this flashpoint seems to be. And that's why I wanted to do tonight as much as we could to bring people up to speed as to why they should be very attentive. And we should think about ways we could intervene in terms of consciousness to change the course of history that's moving in a very disturbing direction here.
Indeed it is. Well, I guess we want to figure out what Erdogan's last, what his endgame is.
Yes. And unfortunately, the music is playing and we're over for the show. Thank you so much, Richard. My guest this morning, Dr. Richard Spence. So until tomorrow morning, same time, same channel. Just remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning.